Hello everyone and welcome to this Lunch and Learn webinar, How to Prepare for Your IT Security Audit. My name is Niamh McGuire and I am the Marketing Executive at FSCom, and I'm delighted to introduce our hosts for this session. Will Finn, our Senior Manager in the Technology Risk Team at FSCom, and Brendan Dugan, our Senior Compliance Associate in the Technology Risk Team as well. So just before I hand over to Brendan and Will, I'm just going to tell you some housekeeping. So we always get asked during the session, is this session recorded? And yes, it is. It is recorded and it will be given to you in a follow-up email after the session and will be available on the FSCom website to download for free. Also, during the webinar, we will launch a couple of polls to encourage some interaction during the session, and we would really appreciate your engagement. Finally, if you have any questions to ask during the session, please post them in the question box that is just available on the side panel, and we will get through as many questions during the Q&A session at the end of the webinar. So that's all from me for now, and I'm going to pass you over to Brendan and Will. Thank you.
Thanks, Niamh. Thanks for joining our webinar, everyone. I'm just going to give you guys a quick overview of FSCom. FSCom has been offering services to financial services clients since 2011. We work in primarily the UK and Ireland because of those organizations, of course, having operations in Europe and typically the US. We have some, we work with a range of clients for those requirements also. We have a number of practices in FSCom. So in the investments team, we have a payments and e-money focused team and a virtual an AML and FinCrime team. And the kinds of services that we offer across those teams include authorizations, audit and advisory work, and other services such as training and interim roles. In terms of the technology risk practice, which Brendan and I work in, our focus here is ensuring that the requirements on financial services firms for IT and security controls are understood, and that firms know how they can respond to those from a risk and a governance perspective, and also right down to an individual controls level. We also work with clients on quite practical testing, such as pen testing. We're working currently with clients on threat scenario testing to meet operational resilience requirements in the UK and EU. Clearly, we do a lot of audit work with our clients. And we also advise clients to respond to regulatory requirements and also to strengthen control frameworks. So, for example, implementing ISO 27001 frameworks, among other activities. So that's just a quick overview of what we do. So moving on, again, my name is Will. I've been working for FSCom for nearly 2 years now, and I have a number of years working in IT programs and change transformation programs, and a number of years working specifically for in cybersecurity programs in banking and financial services firms, and also working as an information security manager in professional services organizations. So Brendan, do you want to give us a quick intro?
Yeah, sure. Hello everyone, I'm Brendan. I'm a Senior Compliance Associate here at FSCom. I joined FSCom actually January 2023, but I've 5 years experience working at a big four consultancy firm, dealing with, you know, a wide range of different industry verticals and stages of the audit process. Trial by fire, so some may say. Just a bit of background. My background's in sort of software development, made the pivot to sort of more a compliance cybersecurity role. Cool. Do you move on and talk through content, Will?
So today we want to just set some context really around IT audit and what it is essentially. Surface some of the terms that we're all familiar with as part of this process, and also some of the legislation and establishing why firms need to do audit and what we're auditing against essentially. We'll take you through then a fairly high level audit process to describe how we typically work with firms and the steps that we go through how this can help you to prepare for IT audit. That will include, of course, the context in an organization for preparing for audit, and also, of course, what you need to do afterwards. So what you need to do with the audit findings. We'll wrap up with some top tips, and we'll take a look also at the future of audit and what's coming and what firms may need to prepare for. And we'll finish up with some questions. So great, let's move on then, Brendan. Let's get stuck into this. Nia, have you got to run a poll for us?
Yes, so the first poll, I'm going to launch the poll now. So first poll is, do you feel prepared for your next IT security audit? It's just a simple yes, no, don't know. We have yet to schedule. So once that you've answered that, then we'll just release the results. So again, do you feel prepared for your next IT security audit? Yes, no, don't know. And then finally, we have yet to schedule. Yep, so just waiting on over 50% of the viewers to vote there. Let's give it a wee minute or two. Yep, perfect. So I'm going to close the poll now and release the results. Yep, so the final results are, so 29% said yes, you are prepared for your next IT security audit. 5% said no. 38% said don't know if they are prepared for their next IT security audit, and then 29% said we have yet to schedule. So I'm going to hide that. So Will and Brendan, what do you feel about those results?
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, I'd expect that a good proportion of people are prepared for audit, because, you know, financial services firms have pretty onerous requirements, and you know, it's not surprising that financial services firms will have made arrangements already to audit. There is a significant portion there, though, of course, who are either don't know or are not ready. Don't know is interesting, and I think that picks up on something that we find quite a lot, which is that compliance professionals in organizations will have a particular approach to audit and will understand why they're doing audit and will have particular drivers for it. Other elements of the business perhaps may have a different approach, or it's have less emphasis on audit. So that communication gap that there tends to be in organizations between compliance and IT ops and perhaps other, you know, security related functions is something that we typically work with clients to overcome, and we take into consideration when we're planning audits. So very interesting. I don't know if you've got any comments, Brendan, on that. Does it?
No, I think I wasn't sure what the output was going to be, but I think that does roughly line up with sort of where we were expecting. You maybe some more prepared than others, and some sort of not sure how prepared they are. Yeah, no, interesting enough, I think.
Great. Let's move on then. So let's get stuck into the meat and two veg of this. Why do firms undertake audits? I mean, there's a short answer to that, of course, which is because, you know, they have to. And they have to for good governance reasons, and also because, you know, regulation requires that audit is undertaken. But, you know, given that driver, the reasons why audit is a very useful tool for firms to use, let's just remind ourselves of that, is essentially audit will help you understand how well your operations are working and if they're working as intended. In addition to affirming how you're complying with your regulations and contracts that apply to you, so that, you know, you're not in any kind of legal jeopardy or any kind of regulatory risk of fine. Audit also implies that there is a high awareness of risk, and which helps a firm prepare to meet any adverse issues that may arise or any challenges that may arise. So, you know, again, audit, it's something which needs to be done. We'll come on in a second to seeing specific requirements from one of the from the EBA guidelines. You know, again, many good reasons why firms need to undertake audit. A quick note about auditors, as auditors, you know, we are professionals, we're bound by particular standards. In my case, the ISACA standards, and for us, of course, FSCOM's own internal quality standards on how we undertake audit. And there are some other key points to remember as well. Auditors are typically independent. So whether the auditor is employed by the organization that it's auditing, or whether it's from an external organization, that point of independence is crucial. So the auditor typically should not be involved in the management or the assessment of risk, and the auditor should not be responsible for delivering controls, because of course either of those might compromise their independence on being able to assess the effectiveness of the control. The audit is designed for stakeholders in an organization, and that is essentially the audience and the clients that the auditor is working for. That might be a board, it might be a head of internal audit, it could be an IT director. But again, that is part of the scope of the audit. And the interests in a lawful manner, of course, but the interests of that stakeholder are the ones that are being addressed in the audit. There's a point there also in terms of audit. You know, Brendan and I, when we work with clients, our aim is to be supportive to those clients. Our aim is to work with them in a collaborative way, so that our clients understand why we're asking the questions we're asking, so that they understand what the specific requirement is. And we also work with clients to make sure that we can highlight areas of good practice, in addition to areas that potentially may be weak and that will that need some form of remediation or action. Mm-hmm. So that again, a quick overview of the role of the auditor: independent, objective, structured. Some audit terms here that are used that you recognize. Assurance is a key one, and what is assurance essentially? To define assurance is providing confidence to somebody that something is as they believe it to be. So it's the provision of confidence. By undertaking a structured audit, that's essentially what you're doing, typically for a board or an audit committee or some other client stakeholder. Essentially, you're giving them confidence that things are operating in the way they should be. Or if they're not operating, that there are actions that can be taken to return it to an effective state. Some other terms there: ISO 27001 is an international standard that's used for information security, to manage information security, and it has its own audit requirements. And typically when you are certified for ISO 27001, you're audited by specialist auditors who audit just that certification. Another one that you may be familiar with, and those organizations who perhaps have colleagues in the United States, the NIST 800 framework is developed by and used in the US, and can be you can get an assertion, essentially, which means that an auditor will check the controls that you have in place against the requirements as described in the NIST framework. There's probably some terms that you're familiar with there, Brendan.
Yeah, it's probably something psychological behind this, but the two that stand out to me, I think, are controls and testing.
Control is a good one. It's a term that's used a lot. Yeah.
No one ever really defines it. So a senior manager in my old job had a really good analogy for this. First day I came in, I was like, well, what on earth is a control? It's brakes on a car, essentially. It stops it stops risk from getting, you know, completely out of control. So I thought that was a useful sort of fundamental way to look at it. Obviously a bit more complicated in application to all your businesses, but yeah, I think that's a sort of a general sort of approach to and understanding what is a control. And testing, I don't want to completely spoil our webinar, but that will be a large portion of what we're going to talk on, so that's potentially why that stood out to me. But essentially, well, when we say testing, and it refers to a control, they go hand in hand, and it's just, is it effective, is it effectively mitigating against risk? I think that's great. My stuff.
Let's crack on here and keep you on our time here, so an IT security audit, again, let's just focus down on what it is essentially we're doing here. An audit is a formal examination, so we will have a formal plan and a formal approach to the controls we're looking at. Again, we're making sure that we're compliant with applicable laws. We're ensuring that the systems and processes comply with governance criteria, and what you have documented in your policies and procedures is in fact what's happening out there by the people who are actually operating these controls. We're focusing on data and information and making sure that we have that those are protected. And finally, that IT operations are effective and efficient, essentially, is what it is we're trying to look at here. So let's move us on through some of the applicable laws and regulations in the EU and the UK. The relationship between the EU and UK has changed, of course, in the past number of years. The UK has yet to diverge significantly from European Union legislation that was enacted when the UK was part of the EU, such as the Second Payment Services Directive that was applied in the PSRs and the EMR legislation later in the UK. But the EBA guidelines for ICT and security risk management are still applied by the FCA in the UK, as well, of course, in the EU jurisdictions. Digital Operational Resilience Act there, which was enacted this year by the EU, of course, is now in force or in the transition period. And there's quite a lot of work happening with that. The FCA has its own arrangements, which are broadly aligned with the Digital Operational Resilience Act. So that's some of the laws and regulations that we are typically asked to audit against. So let's move on. And I think we're looking at, so this is the EBA guidelines specific requirement for audit. So just again, to kind of put some flesh on the bones here about what's required. So essentially, you must do audit, you must have an audit plan, you must have some way to govern audit and to ensure that audit is happening as planned. You must have some way to manage the outcomes of audits and to ensure that you have remediation plans in place and that you're tracking progress for actions so that you can bring your controls back into effectiveness as quickly as possible. Right, so let's get into the core of this then, which is essentially the audit process itself. We've developed this pretty high level diagram, just five steps that Brendan is going to take you through in a second, starting with the pre-audit, so essentially the context of the organization which drives a specific audit to take place, and then for a specific audit, the planning activities that we'll undertake with you and with our clients, the field work that we do and what takes place typically in an audit in field work, the reporting process, and then what the kinds of steps that organizations should take after the audit. So Brendan, if you want to take us into the first step there, let me have a quick overview of the pre-audit in terms of the context of an organization. Essentially, the assumption here is that firms manage risk. Some do it more formally than others. Some do it in a more structured, documented way than others, but firms will manage risk. Firms also will implement controls to mitigate that risk. Again, some will do that in a very structured, very documented way, and some less so. Perhaps startups or other organizations will do it in a less formal way. Regardless, we start from where clients are to gather that information in. There is also an assumption that clients will have some form of an audit strategy or plan. Startups, perhaps less so, more mature organizations are likely to have a very well articulated strategy and plan that we can work with. But again, that sets the context for us in a particular organization, which is a backdrop to the specific audit that we're doing.
I suppose off the back of that, there can be more ad hoc reasons, such as like IT incidents, third party security risk management, things like that nature.
Absolutely.
Okay, so planning, a key one that we thought is important to illustrate. This is an example of the audit pack that we share with clients. And we think this is important because this really outlines the key three deliverables that we want them to be thinking about. And it's illustrated by these sort of columns here. So the review element and control, well, that's our scope. That's our control areas. That's where the areas that we're going to examine in detail. The column stage two, documentation. Look at that as our documentation request. That's the things that we want to see to begin to make those assertions on how effectively your controls have been designed. And then in the column three, stage three, is something that we think is important and it does add value. And that's around additional material that isn't the policy, that isn't sort of neatly defined by policies and procedures. Things that can be used as evidence in a walkthrough, in an interview to test control implementation and effectiveness. Great example here would be, okay, you have an access management policy, you have a role, you have an access matrix. Can we see some evidence of those reviews being being completed. Can we see the list you use? How do you ensure that's up to date? You can already see like the mind map that you can make from those different pieces of evidence. Anyone you want to touch on, Will, here?
I think the key thing here again is we're engaging with our client for the first time, you know, for a specific audit. And part of the planning here is, again, confirming the scope with them, you know, making sure that we're helping the firm to kind of understand what it is they've taken on, helping perhaps communications with specific stakeholders or control owners. So again, we aim to, you know, document things as clearly as we can. Looking at the review element slash control here, the aim of that, again, of course, is that while some firms will have a very well articulated controls framework, they'll know exactly what is required. Other firms may not. So we try to keep a pretty high level in terms of how we describe the review element, essentially. In terms then of the documentation that we request, we ask firms to send to us. Again, you know, we're suggesting titles for policies here. We're not saying that, for example, you know, you must have an access management policy. Some firms may have. Exactly, not at all. It's really what we're trying to do is you may, for example, have a high level information security policy, and one element of that is access controls. You might describe them in that. But again, what we're trying to identify for people is that, you know, start asking yourself the question, how do you manage your access? What standards have you put in place? What policy is in place for that? So we, again, as just to reiterate what Brendan said, I suppose really is this is helpful for us and for our clients to confirm our scope, to begin the conversation around, okay, what have you documented and where is it? And can you send it to us, please? And then also to prepare the client for later stages of the audit, where we'll be digging in much more detail. We typically do this in a kickoff meeting, essentially. So we'll have a fairly formal agenda meeting where we'll work through this with clients to start the audit.
Generally, we'd share this information as far in advance as possible ahead of that kickoff meeting, and then just use that as the sort of agenda to drive that meeting. Obviously, key deliverables will come out of that meeting. You know, time and diaries and things like that, and getting availability from people. But the main thing is just this ironed out.
So let's move on to field work.
So
this is where Brendan gets on the plane and spends 3 weeks in Nottingham.
That was the case at one point, becoming less and less of a reality, unfortunately. No more trips to Nottingham. This is the beginning of the audit proper, if you will. I think whenever people think of what an audit is, it's kind of this. This is it, what you have in your head, the guys in the suits coming in. So control design is the first thing that we think about whenever we begin our fieldwork, and that's assessing the effectiveness of the controls from the relevant documentation you've provided. We're looking at key policies, strategies, plans, documents, everything in that column one that we've outlined in the previous slide in the audit pack. And we do this for a couple of reasons. We want to assess against general requirements, and a general requirement like the EBA guidelines that Will pointed out earlier, our firms should manage risk. One level below that, we want to assess them against specific requirements. So a more specific requirement is critical systems should be tested annually. And there's actually a lot to unpack there. Critical systems, that to me defines that you've defined a specific system as being critical. So you've looked at all your systems and made an assertion as this is the most important one. And then an annual test on top of that. And then a sort of overarching quality assessment. We just want to know it's up to date. It's been reviewed and approved by the appropriate senior business owner or board of directors, if that's the case. This is a good way to sort of, you can get ahead of this, I think, in the pre-audit stage. You can have these all reviewed. If you know an audit's coming up, maybe put everything through a review, I think would be a sort of a key tip there. And then we just may want to identify sort of specific topics for.
I think that last bit is quite key, of course, because the documentation, of course, is going to explain what the firm intends to do, what the standard they have set for themselves, the procedure that they have outlined. And that, as it goes, is a good start. Many firms, you know, perhaps have not done that, so they're, you know, further behind on that maturity scale. But of course, what we want to do next is we want to say, okay, you've made this statement in the document, and yes, it complies with your regulatory requirements. So that's a good thing. So now we're going to test it, So the document review will give us a long list of let's check this, let's check this, let's check this, let's test that, let's ask for evidence for this, so that we can do that, again, provide that assurance. So we can do that structured inquiry, which will provide assurance that things are working as they should or not. So that's a crucial part of the first stage of field work, and a crucial output of the document review.
Yeah, I agree. That's a really good point, actually. That leads us into, as Will sort of appropriately mentioned, that there are two phases to this. And the next phase is the control implementation phase. And this is, in simple terms, this is just how effectively are the controls you've designed in your policies working? How has it been applied into your business setting? Is it operating well or effectively at mitigating the risk it was originally designed for? So there's different ways we can do this. This is not a step-by-step process. We use a blend of lots of these approaches based on the control, based on the organization. But some we just thought we would like to highlight to you. So inquiry, we'll have an interview with everyone who's identified as a stakeholder. And then, that provides us with some degree of assurance, but not a lot. We may want to see one more, but we want to see a little bit more beyond that. So that's why we would potentially look into an observation-based approach to where we'd like to observe some of the procedures that they conduct. Maybe we want to see how a database admin is given a database admin rights on a specific cloud service platform. Maybe we want to make sure, and that's how we'll start diving into that as a process. Something that's very common is examination or inspection of evidence. And it, again, slightly more of a manual control where we're inspecting that specific things have happened, specifically like a form or report being sent to a board, maybe visitors being logged into the building correctly, things like that where manual error is sort of a risk there, I think, human interaction.
In terms of, just to pick up on that implementation term and why that term is used, so implementation, of course, is how the document, the policy or standard or procedure that you've documented has actually been rolled out across your business. So in large, more complex businesses, of course, that's often quite tricky. A great example of this, for example, is the issue of cloud IT, shadow IT. Given the ubiquity of cloud services these days, it's quite easy for particular parts of a business to acquire and manage cloud or SaaS services to meet their own particular requirements. And they can do that largely without, other elements of the organization or perhaps the IT or compliance functions having any great oversight into how that's being managed. So that would imply there that any policy statements around centralized controls or the acquisition and maintenance of cloud or SaaS services potentially have not been fully implemented. And that is why you would undertake that specific inquiry. To make sure that you're taking a sample and you're testing to make sure that the policy has been implemented everywhere, not just in central or central services or central functions.
And I think again that sort of third-party security is something that's been a theme that sort of popped up in our examples, and that just sort of further illustrates the considerations that need to be in place when dealing with quite a in-depth topic like that, where your cloud service providers, your outsourced service providers. A blended approach of those three is probably where we would go when testing such a big concept like that. Some less used methods of testing, re-performance and computer-aided audit tools, don't necessarily have the time to re-perform every single control your business conducts on a daily basis. But I think a useful example here, the some of the payment service guys on the call would be where I've had to physically calculate fraud rates for specific transactions for a platform, and I've had to make sure that they align with what's been reported. So unfortunately I was the guy with the calculator on that one, but that's just an example to show you that we can, if that assurance is required, like, because it is required by the regulator that you're reporting accurate fraud rates, we'll absolutely have to go in there with unfortunately with a calculator and type it all out. But these tools are here. Computer-aided audit tools, just quickly, this could be anything. This could be a macro-enabled spreadsheet that Will and I develop to a bespoke piece of data analytics software. Plenty of methods to test. Hopefully that makes it a little bit more transparent what that actually means. Yeah, let's move on to initial feedback. I think this is a really important step that we, Will and I, wanted to align with you guys. This is your opportunity to challenge initial findings and present additional evidence. I can't stress this enough, but whenever a report's on its third draft, that's not really an appropriate time to be saying, I have this evidence, or oh, I have this. This is a really good opportunity because the report hasn't been developed yet, and a good auditor should be highlighting any sort of discrepancy as it comes up. They may not be able to hang their hat on it and say this is a high risk finding, but at this point in time, they should have a fair idea saying, you know, you're looking good business continuity, you're looking good in information security, but your software development processes need a bit of work. Let's have a chat about where we think they may potentially need work, and then maybe that's your opportunity to say, oh, we agree or disagree with that. And then the third point here, audits are an examination of a point in time. So it is considered a gap, unfortunately, if you cannot produce the required evidence during the given time. I have a quick example to illustrate this, which I thought was quite cruel. I was auditing a really big client before, and their SOC 2 Type 2 report was currently being assessed. So they had auditors in simultaneously with me to do their SOC 2. And so it technically wasn't there. So I said to my manager at the time, I was like, oh, I think this is compliant. No, it's not there. We don't know that report's going to come back compliant. So that sort of illustrates that point in time thing. If you can't provide it to the auditors, it's not really effectively there. Some examples of findings I thought we would provide you, because it's not always, you know, the case where you're going to be provided lots of findings. We're in a very weird position where we see lots of findings. So we thought these are some, and I think we'll agree, these are kind of current trending findings that we're seeing in the industry, and that's sort of around policies not requiring specific things. In this case, it was a frequent review for high privilege user authorizations. And then this one's kind of in line with what you're dealing with clients at the minute on business continuity, Will, about around testing. Do you want to just quickly touch on the finding raised here for testing?
Business continuity, of course, is something which most firms have had in place for a number of years. It's considered good practice, essentially. Most firms will have a policy where they will require testing of their business continuity plans, typically annually, but with some regular cadence. We find typically that firms, don't do their business continuity testing, or their business continuity plans are not adequate, essentially, to meet the risk that actually exists. So, of course, that position has now changed given operational resilience requirements in the EU and UK, and business continuity testing has become certainly higher up the priority list, but also more onerous in that business continuity testing should now include threat scenario testing, and that should be completed regularly, essentially. So, in addition to all of the other changes that operational resilience brings to that kind of that business continuity framework, business continuity approach, but that's a standard one. People typically say, for example, we undertook a test, a real live test, which was the COVID response, and we responded very well to that, etc. That's a valid test, absolutely right. I'd be looking for a report, though, of course, as in, so where did you do your report on how your response to COVID actually worked? And that might be acceptable for your business continuity testing in 2020 mm-hmm. or 2021. We're now in 2023. So the question would be, what did you do last year? What are you planning to do this year? And that's, again, how we would assess, are you actually doing what you've stated you should do in your policy, which will reflect the requirement in the legislation and the regulation?
A great point. Great point. What have you done recently, I think, is the key takeaway there with business continuity, isn't it?
Exactly. Okay. It's an ongoing requirement.
Reporting. The third and final step in the audit phase, pretty straightforward. We're documenting everything that's happened here. So our findings and our recommendations. From my perspective, there's a clear handover between Will and I in this, where I finish documenting and I hand over to Will. So I think that's probably an appropriate point to hand over. So for me, I'm trying to clearly describe the assessment of each control, the design and effectiveness of them, in a positive and a negative way. We want to say what you're doing well as opposed to what you can improve on. Identification of findings. I want to put a risk assessment on the findings. I want to say this is a high risk finding, medium, low recommendation. Then recommendations for remediation, corrective action. So the findings we raise will always attach a recommendation to how best to correct that. They'll also be assigned an individual and have a target remediation date. And then sort of this is whenever it naturally transitions over to Will for internal quality assurance and then an internal challenge between he and I. Do you want to talk about sort of your role in this phase, Will?
Yeah, so certainly, I mean, quality assurance is crucial, essentially. You know, it's how we support auditors like Brendan, how I'm supported when I do audits. And essentially, it's the challenge. It's the person who reminds us and holds us to account against the standards that are set for us as professionals, but also internally in FSCom in terms of our approach to audits. So have we met the standards? Have we met the scope of the audit as agreed with the client? Have we documented completely all of the findings? Have we linked those to specific requirements? Have we made recommendations and are those clear? So essentially it's making sure that the audit is fit for purpose and that it meets the requirements that we'd agreed with the client originally. And also that there is some challenge to the findings that have been made. You know, challenge such as, well, did you ask for additional documentation? You know, who did you speak to? And there's a challenge which should strengthen the findings of the audit in that we should be able to say, yes, in fact, we did take all reasonable steps to gather information and to assess what was provided to us and to test. And yes, we can stand by this finding, which again makes it more useful to clients and helps build that confidence that we're aiming to provide with this assurance activity. It just then, of course, I mean, the audit is essentially pretty much complete at that point when we present the report to the client. Typically, the client at this point will document their own management responses to our findings. So they'll say, you know, we accept this finding or we accept this with these reservations. And then that is essentially the complete audit.
Just before we pick up here, Will, conscious of time, do you want to quickly, because I do know we have questions we'd like to get to, do you want to just quickly make a summary over the next slide or two?
Absolutely. I mean, so once the audit is handed back to the client, there's an assumption, of course, that certain things are going to happen. And, you know, as we had a brief glance at the EBA guidelines earlier, and the EBA guidelines make it clear that there is a requirement for firms to act upon audit findings. So clearly, risk is the first thing that's impacted by the findings of an audit. If you're relying on a particular control to mitigate your risk, audit findings might indicate to you that, in fact, your risk assessment is incorrect because you should not be relying on the control. The control is weak. So risk assessment is immediately impacted by audit findings. Some other outcomes, perhaps, would be third-party suppliers. You know, if there are audit findings relating to cloud providers or other third parties, and indicating weaknesses in how they manage their information security controls, you may need to engage with that client, or sorry, with that supplier, and either request more information from them, and it could result in a contract renegotiation or some other action to monitor that client. Or you may even consider, for example, a significant change, such as swapping out that supplier for somebody else. In terms of the remediations then, so the findings will indicate that there are certain actions to be taken, certain remediation actions. Typically, you should prioritize these first. So which ones are most important? Which ones should we be doing first? That should be driven by risk, typically. The corrective actions, of course, will probably require some resource, that certainly requires somebody's attention for a period of time. And so they need to be absolutely supported and signed off by senior management. Target date set, and some form of oversight to make sure that once the target is set and the remediation action is agreed, that it actually happens. And then finally, of course, there's the tracking of that progress to make sure that, you know, whether that's to an audit committee or an information security committee, that's happening as planned. So yeah, let's crack on with this.
Apologies, my mouse just clicked by itself.
Not at all. Let's crack on. I mean, just looking at some quick quick ones here. I'm looking at number 7 and number 8 because I think this is important. Again, in the spirit of an audit being a collaboration.
Oh, yeah.
If you don't have the information to hand to answer an auditor's question, you are perfectly entitled to say, I don't have that information right now. I can't answer that question. I will go and find out for you, and I will ensure you have it before the end of the audit. And the auditor will include that in their findings. And then the next one is that if the auditor makes a finding, shares it with you as part of the initial findings, you may have time to actually fix that before the audit is finished. And if you do, the auditor is likely to accept your evidence that the finding has been addressed and the weakness has been fixed, and they will remove that finding. So again, approach it in a collaborative spirit as an auditor will. The auditor wants you to succeed. The auditor wants to kind of give a good, to find areas of good practice and areas of compliance.
Just add a bit of weight to that, the point you made on 7. I actually block out a day, and at the top of my calendar, I call it follow-up to deal with all the follow-ups throughout the audit. So it's something I'm fully expecting. And I think it just is the sign of a healthy audit, to be honest. Cool. Let's, conscious of time, let's quickly get to these questions. Just one slide here on look into the future.
So the way audits are happening is likely to change for a number of reasons. And I think it's important for us to while we understand, the standards, the current standards of audit and the current approaches to audit, which you've just outlined, that in future, it's likely that things may be different for a number of reasons. Risk, the perception of risk is greater now than it has been at any point in the past. And that's being responded to by regulators requiring, for example, operation resilience frameworks and operation resilience testing. And of course, the audit that comes with that to make sure that, firms are actually doing what they should be doing. There are larger amounts of data available, and it's likely that regulators are going to be requesting that more frequently, and that regulator oversight is going to increase in the future. And that it's important for firms to understand how they might meet that requirement, essentially. And there's also the possibility that in the future, our current point in time audits will change to a more continuous audit approach. All of this is made possible, facilitated by new tooling and automation tooling that's available. And some of you may have already implemented tooling which supports data collection, which supports controls monitoring, which supports automated testing, all of which, of course, will facilitate your audits going forward. In fact, some of the ISO 27001 certification partners have already partnered with providers of automated compliance tooling, and they use that as part of their certification and maintenance audits. So it's something that you're likely to hear a lot more about going forward. And when you're planning for audit going forward, perhaps setting your audit strategies, if you're looking perhaps to a 3 or 5 year timescale, I'd encourage you to look at automation and the tooling that's out there, and that can support what is likely to be a greater audit burden going forward.
Good points, really good points, actually.
Yep, so this is our final poll of the session before going to Q&A. So I will just launch the poll. So what is the main thing stopping you from feeling prepared? Is it a lack of skills and experience? Shortage of resources? Lack of senior management support? Ever increasing expectations of the regulator? And then finally, existing internal audits not completed. So if you would please answer, just select one of those answers, and then when the results have been gathered, I will launch the results. So again, what is the main thing stopping you from feeling prepared? So lack of skill experience, shortage of resources, lack of senior management support, ever increasing expectations of the regulator, finally, existing internal audits not completed. So just waiting for this to get over 50%. If you still vote just one last time. That's perfect. So I'm going to close the poll and release the results. So So 32% said lack of skills and experience, 32% said shortage of resources, only 5% said lack of senior management support, 11% said ever-increasing expectations of the regulator, and 21% said existing internal audits not completed. So what do you feel about those results, Will and Brendan?
I mean, I think there's no doubt that audit places a burden on organizations. It certainly does. You know, so the fact that, you know, there's a lack of skill, a lack of resource, it reflects that essentially. Audit does take time, and it does place a management overhead and resourcing overhead on organizations. So I think that's to be expected. It's good to see that there is a let's say relatively positive indication of support from senior management, which again I would expect because you know, senior management will recognize the value, and also of course just the bottom line, it's a requirement. It absolutely needs to be done. So you might as well make a benefit out of a, you know, out of a requirement. So interesting results.
Yeah, that was good. Okay, shall we move into our key takeaways. Will, do you want to run through your key takeaway for this session?
Yeah. I mean, again, I'm just going to reiterate that, you know, audit is, you know, it's scary, it's an overhead, it's formal, auditors are independent, they're objective, all of those things. But the fundamental point to remember is that, you know, you should approach your audits as a supportive collaboration with the auditor. The auditor is there to help you identify areas of good practice, and help you to identify areas of weakness which need to be fixed so that you can, you know, address your risk properly. It should not really be approached as a test. That's the way to get the best out of an audit, is to approach it as an aid to improvement.
I agree. Just on that, yeah, my point is just on planning and preparedness. Will and I have probably completed thousands of audits between the both of us, and we both agree that most findings could have been mitigated by some basic planning, which is unfortunate, but it's also should be a realization there's quick wins to be made, and you can perform very well in an audit with just some basic planning.
Absolutely.
Cool. Let's move into Q&A now.
Yep. So there has been a few questions prompted throughout the session. And so I will ask the first one now and then see which one of you want to take it. So can you describe the IT security controls necessary for cross-jurisdictional outsourcing services? So Will, would you like to take that one? Let me know if you want to repeat.
No, that's fine. So with the keywords I heard, they were outsourcing and cross jurisdiction. So that's what I will answer to. I mean, it's essentially the controls that govern your outsourcing are similar to the ones that will manage any other suppliers. There will be some specific types of requirements in your agreements with suppliers that will need to be addressed for outsourcing particular kinds of services. In terms of managing suppliers, you're really relying on your contracts, essentially, and your contracts should address, for example, the split of responsibilities between you and your outsourcing partner. They should clearly identify your requirements for information security specifically and IT security specifically that you have for your client. You should make it really clear what kind of assurance you need from your client. For example, the big cloud providers such as AWS have many assertions, certifications, which they will provide, for clients. Smaller suppliers are likely to be more flexible than larger suppliers. You should also ensure, you know, that you have the standard contract management service level standards in place, and there's an understanding between suppliers how frequently that's going to happen and what's required. Essentially, other things that are important, things like incident management. So those are the controls that you're looking at, essentially. In terms of the cross-jurisdictional, there is unlikely to be any enormous difference between those standard IT controls, certainly between the jurisdictions that we work between. The standard controls that I've outlined will typically meet requirements in both jurisdictions. Now, certainly there will, of course, be certain specific things that need to be taken into consideration. So, for example, EU requirements for sharing of data, for example, to countries with an equal standard of data protection, is a particular requirement to be taken into consideration when working cross jurisdiction. But those standard controls that are good practice, reasonable controls that everyone should have in place so that their suppliers can be managed, is the core of managing. And then adjustments should be made for specific jurisdictions.
Perfect, thank you. Brendan, I think this one's going to be targeted at you. So do IT security audits give insight to a business's approach to security, or do they focus on testing security processes?
So I think if I heard the question correctly, there's two asks. So fundamentally, it's dependent on the objectives you set in your audit plan. But I think my answer, and although it's probably not super helpful, is both. Yes, it can accomplish both. Can you just read that second part of the question just to ensure that I was...
So, or do they focus on testing security processes?
Yeah, so it's very much both. Your security processes are going to be tested as part of that, but then your overall strategy and approach is something that's going to be blended between a governance side of things before the audit and our pre-audit section, if you will, that we discussed today. And then briefly, we will tackle that in the sort of more governance aspects of controls and things like that.
Perfect. Okay. And then we have two more questions, I'd say. What ideas for managing repository of evidence / documents, and more importantly, keeping them up to date without duplication?
Okay. I mean, again, look, this is about the overhead that audit and, you know, putting control frameworks in places and organizations. You know, it does require maintenance. So putting them in place in the first place, documenting, and then maintaining documents is an overhead. There's no doubt about that. In terms of repositories, I mean, if you use a tool like Confluence, for example, that's a good way to document and share and have a central repository to ensure that if any changes are made, they're made across all versions immediately. In terms of a repository of documents, that's one thing I would suggest. Again, I mentioned, tooling. There are specific tools available which to focus on compliance and management of controls frameworks, which might be useful for you. Most of the firms that we work with, they are still documenting on Word documents. They are still managing document repositories on an Excel spreadsheet, probably. This would be, quite cutting edge technology focused financial services firms. It certainly is an overhead. It certainly is complicated, but there are tools out there that can help if you're prepared to make the investment.
Thank you. The next question is probably the final question we'll have time for. So, what is an acceptable standard of policy and procedure documentation to meet audit requirements? Does every IT operational procedure have to be documented? Is that similar?
I mean, it's a great question. Again, the EBA guidelines are really clear. Documentation is required, and it's required for very good reasons, in that you need to be able to demonstrate that you have a structured approach to the delivery of services, for example, in procedures. However, that doesn't mean that everything has to be documented. It is possible to describe how things happen. And as long as how you're describing things, it can be supported in a walkthrough, for an audit purpose, that is sufficient. There is no rule that says if this procedure is not documented, it's like an immediate finding. That's absolutely not the case. What we do find, though, is that those firms who have documented their procedures tend to be able to implement them more effectively, and they're able to monitor them more effectively to ensure that they're actually they're meeting their stated purpose. But there is absolutely no requirement to document, but certainly for complex procedures, it's probably preferable. And also, in order to make sure that everybody understands what the procedure is, and that it can be communicated and trained out to new starters as necessary. All sorts of good reasons why you should document, But in terms of an audit finding, it's not, you know, it's not a finding if it's not documented. It might be, though, we recommend that you do, because you'd find it more useful.
Thank you. So if that is all we have time for the question and Q&A, any questions not answered, Will and Brendan will follow up by the end of the week, hopefully, or next week. So thank you, Will and Brendan, for an informative session. I thought it was great, really informative. And again, just to remind everyone that this session is recorded and it will be sent to you in a follow-up email tomorrow. I will get it out tomorrow. And then it'll be on our FSCon website early next week. And thank you, everyone, for attending the session, and hope you have a lovely day.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Thanks for having it.
Bye.